Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Photosynthesis is the basis of life on Earth, but it's much more than that. Solar energy captured by plants provides all of the fuel we will use in our lives. My name is Andrea Sella, and I'm a chemist at University College London. This edition of Discovery on the BBC is about using chemistry to improve on the photosynthesis of plants, taking energy from the sun to make fuels for our future. It's an idea that some are taking very seriously.
We've begun to reinvent our energy policy. We're not just handing out money. We're issuing a challenge. We're telling America's scientists and engineers that if they assemble teams of the best minds in their fields and focus on the hardest problems in clean energy, we'll fund the Apollo projects of our time.
Obama gave us a shout out. That gave us a huge boost here.
At the California Institute of Technology, they're developing a way to turn sunlight and water into fuel for our cars.
A thousand years from now, people are going to be doing and using what we're developing right now and what these kids are developing right now. In a thousand years from now, people who are living off sunlight, water, and CO2 with our devices are going to be thanking these kids for having the guts and the passion and so forth.
We're going to need more energy. In fact, there's never been a year in human history when humans have used less energy than they did in the year before.
This given enzyme, this reaction center, photosystem 2, the one that splits water, is actually the enzyme that changed the planet.
Artificial photosynthesis, the idea of taking sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide, just as plants do, and making fuels directly, has the potential to sit alongside all the existing clean energy options available to us. Nuclear, wind, tidal, solar, by storing the energy in chemical bonds, just as in coal, oil, or biomass.
We need to figure out a way to store massive quantities of electricity if we are to bring on large intermittent resources like solar and wind. At the same time, over 40% of global transportation is now in a sector that cannot be electrified. Ships, heavy-duty trucks, and aircraft, for which we absolutely need a carbon-neutral, high-energy-density transportation fuel. Those two gaps can simultaneously be met, but arguably only simultaneously be met, by exploiting the biggest resource, the sun, and directly making carbon-neutral fuel from that resource.
Nate Lewis. That, of course, is what leaves have been doing for millions of years. So how do they do it? In school, you may remember learning about water from soil plus photons of light from the sun and carbon dioxide from the air combining to make sugars and ultimately more plant that we eat or burn for fuel. All this happens with the help of chlorophylls, the pigments that make plants green. One of the few people who come close to understanding this complex process is Bill Rutherford at Imperial College London.
Most of the chlorophyll you see is only doing physics. Light collection and passing that energy between the pigments. And then you get to the special bit where it does the chemistry, and that's in the reaction centres. And the chlorophyll's involved in that too, but the chlorophylls there are slightly more special than the vast majority of chlorophylls. They're in an environment where instead of passing on the energy, they actually pass on electrons.
So you separate the electron from the atom that is left behind. So you separate charge, plus and minus.
You separate charge essentially between two chlorophylls. One chlorophyll give one away, and one chlorophyll-like species will pick one up. And that means you've got a hole, and where's left a space and a charge, and another chlorophyll close by that's got an extra electron on it. And those things are then very reactive. One will want to give the electron to something else, and one will want to take an electron from somewhere else.
And before you ask, it's not possible to get chlorophyll to work outside the leaf in a test tube. So the race is on to find other materials that can do the same thing. As Bill Rutherford said, the first crucial step in harvesting sunlight is to get a photon of light to strip out electrons from atoms and keep them apart from what are called the holes they leave behind. Using these electrons and holes to make fuel is the real challenge in this area. Professor Harry Gray of Caltech in the U.S. explains.
The technical part of the whole thing is to get the light absorption, very, very efficient light absorption in devices like semiconductors, to get very efficient electron hole separation, and that's the big technical problem because in cheap materials, electrons and holes don't move apart very far. They tend to recombine just to make heat on the spot. If they recombine to make heat, you just heat up the device and you've lost the ball game. If leaves did that, they'd all burn up instantly when the sunlight hit them. But leaves know how to separate electrons and holes. They know how to take the holes with catalyst and make oxygen that bubbles out, and they know how the electrons take them and reduce carbon dioxide to sugars. We have to figure that out. It's light absorption, it's electron transfer, and then it's catalysis with real catalyst.
Though each step can be described, the problem is so complex that there's a real need for scientists from different fields to pool their expertise. In fact, there are dozens of different approaches to this problem. And so a few weeks ago, the Royal Society of Chemistry organized a meeting in London of some of the world's leading experts on artificial photosynthesis. Imperial College's James Durrant was one of the organizers.
It's an invitation-only meeting intended to foster discussion, which is a... You'll see, it's obvious this is not an area where there's lots of consensus.
Well, I think what's interesting is just the level of, kind of, let's say, skeptical criticism that is coming from peers.
It's a dynamic field, and we started a program at Imperial about 4 years ago where we started to bring together both the chemists and the engineers to see what we could do.
An artificial leaf sounds pretty impressive. To get an idea of the sort of system that Professor Durrant is talking about, I popped across to Imperial's Chemical Engineering Department, where I talked to PhD student Chin Kin Ong, who explained their approach to me.
So the reactor consists of two main compartments. So one is the compartment where you have your anode, and the other compartment is where you have your cathode. You generate your electrons and...
What may surprise you is the language Chin is using. The terms cathode and anode are the ones you might have heard in school to describe the places where water is split in electrolysis, the splitting of water with electricity. The big difference here is that the whole process is driven by light falling on a thin layer of orange-colored rust.
Then to your cathode, then this is the cathode where your hydrogen evolution reactions would...
So this is now kind of further away from the window. You've got a sort of second plate.
Yes, which is a titanium, a platinized titanium mesh.
The idea, then, is that the rust in the window at the front of the cell separates the electrons from the holes. The holes are used to make oxygen, while the electrons flow through an electrical circuit and make hydrogen at the back.
Does it work?
It does. In principle, yes.
In principle. And in fact, that might not sound like a real leaf to you. After all, it's just the first phase of what a real leaf would do. In other words, a physical device that uses light to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. Green leaves, of course, go further, turning hydrogen into other more stable, storable substances like sugars. But to a chemist, hydrogen sounds like a pretty good fuel already. And indeed, there are lots of other artificial leaves out there, of which perhaps the most famous was one from the Nocera lab at MIT, which was published to some fanfare in November 2011. Joep Pijpers of MIT's spin-off company, Sun Catalytics, told me about this approach to the artificial leaf.
Basically, we glue or we stick the catalyst on the silicon PV element. We immerse the whole structure in a beaker of water. We illuminate it by light, that is mimicking the intensity and also the color of sunlight. And then we could see that bubbles of hydrogen and bubbles of oxygen were evolving from the structure. So we thought that was a very nice concept. It's just you immerse a sheet-like structure in a beaker of water, illuminate it, and you can see the fuel evolving that you want to make.
It was an impressive demonstration. But crucial to its working is the silicon PV, or photovoltaic, the solar cell at its heart. In a commercial world, it is commercial considerations that rule.
you know, we are a company, so we had a very good scientific idea. We could make it in a lab. We made artificial leaf. We published that in Science, the scientific journal. It turned out that it would be quite expensive compared to more conventional ways of generating hydrogen. It may become more cost-effective, but then the starting point, the silicon solar cell, basically, that should become much more cheap than it currently is. That may happen in the future, but we are not a PV company. We cannot really drive that innovation. So that is why we started to develop an alternative technology that is basically doing exactly the same thing as the artificial leaf, namely absorbing light, creating electrons and holes in your light absorber, directing that to an interface with water and splitting the water into hydrogen and oxygen, but now on a very small scale. It can be 10 nanometer, it can be 1 micrometer, we're not really sure about it yet. But in any case, it should have all the same functionalities that I was just describing.
Chin Kin Ong explained to me why a single material, in his case iron oxide, rust, might not be able to work on its own.
The problem is, when you use iron oxide, the conduction band, the energy band level where your electrons sort of move around, it's below the hydrogen evolution energy potential. So you just do not have the right amount of energy to have the electrons to jump from the cathode into water to produce hydrogen.
In order to split water, you need at least 1.23 volt. That is dictated by thermodynamics. The band gap of silicon, with band gap, I mean like what kind of voltage you can get out, is 1.1 volt, electron volt. And in practice, a silicon solar cell has a much lower output. It's about 0.6 volt. So by using a single silicon particle, you will never be able to achieve water splitting. So silicon is not the most logical material to go for.
And so what is needed is to find a material that would deliver the electrons at the right energy to split water. Just in the last few weeks, chemists have described oxides, sulfides, carbon nitrides, even the pale yellow element sulfur that seem to fit this. The problem is that with 90 potential ingredients that might be combined in a single, robust material, the number of permutations and combinations is just vast. So how might one explore this enormous universe of possibilities? You need an army. A solar army.
Hi, my name is Sitara Hirji. I'm a senior at Polytechnic School in Pasadena, and I'm 18 years old, graduating in a couple of weeks. Basically, the guy who created this, the professor at Caltech, his name is Harry Gray, he came up with the idea to kind of reach out to high school students, which was really, really amazing of him. And he created the Solar Army, which started here in Pasadena, and it's now across the globe, across the nation. It's a huge army of us, basically, and we all work towards this one goal of harnessing solar energy. Well, they're out there having fun.
I decided to set this up because we desperately need a catalyst for water oxidation that are as good or better than the one in green leaves. And these kids are searching for new materials with a search algorithm we have and a solar energy kit that we've developed here. And they're doing it as an after-school activity. They're doing real research, making new compositions of matter, screening it for water oxidation activity and reporting their results on the web. We can then take these finds of theirs and scale them up or try to reproduce them, try to see what they're made of and so forth. So it's an ongoing activity where they're searching for these new materials, and then here at Caltech we can really work them up. The catalysts are the end of this food chain. They're the things that then take these electrons and holes and make them into fuels and chemicals. And we figured it out with expensive materials. We've got it working with expensive materials, 10 times better than natural photosynthesis. That's pretty good. And now we've got to figure out how to do it with really cheap stuff so we can scale it up.
But Caltech is also the focus of a coordinated and well-funded project to develop these kinds of ideas, led by Professor Nate Lewis.
JCAP is an acronym for the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis. a United States Department of Energy's Innovation Hub. And under this rubric, we are bringing together at a funding level of $25 million per year for 5 years, almost 200 scientists, engineers, and product developers, all in two sites, in two buildings. In this vision, we are trying to tie together from the basic fundamental discovery research all the way through to the systems engineering and real product prototyping, the entire R&D supply chain all at once, so that we don't have to wait 5 years to make the discoveries that are needed and five more years to see that they might be practically implemented and five more years to see that we might be able to make a cost-effective product out of them and five more years to see that it could be proven for use by consumers or by industry. We're trying to do this all at once, all with an integrated team of people to shorten this product development cycle so that we could bring this technology from a laboratory concept into a practical implementation in a highly accelerated way.
Big science type approaches to research and development are one way of tackling big problems. But the other is private enterprise. Joep Pieper from Sun Catalytics again.
People, in principle, don't really care whether their energy source is hydrogen or gasoline. It just has to be cheap. It's a commodity. It's not like an iPad where people are willing to pay a lot of money for fancy gadget, basically. Energy needs to be cheap, so that's why we are targeting solar fuel-based products that we think we can make as cheap as possible.
But whether the solution will come from private or publicly funded support, for Nate Lewis, there's no time to lose.
It's actually time to see if this dog can hunt, to see if we can have the pieces together and assemble the systems that I think we will be able to do. Now, that said, the first systems are probably not going to work very well. The second systems are not going to work well. But in fact, having the bold courage to fail is what is exactly needed to get off the ground the fifth time as one persists and learns from their mistakes. Otherwise, if one doesn't have that bold courage, you will, in a self-fulfilling prophecy, never get to the end point that we're shooting for. Is it chemically derived?
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.